force against the underbeams that the saloon bar with its brass footrail fell through the floor and floated out and away through a bulkhead. The station master saw it go. As obsessed with omens as he was, he slept two nights in a row in his office for fear that the station house was in danger. Candy was so huge, she hardly slept at all. The morning that the hill was bare, Homer Wells tested the ground. He could work a spade almost a foot down before he hit frozen earth. He needed another 6 inches of thawing before he could plant apple trees. But he dared not wait any longer before making the trip to Hart's Rock to get the trees. He didn't want to be away when Candy delivered. Olive was surprised to see him, and by his request to trade the Cadillac for one of the pickup trucks to transport the baby trees. "I want to plant a standard 40x40," Homer told Olive. "Half max, about 10% Red Delicious, another 10 or 15% Cortlands and Baldwins." Olive reminded him to throw in a few Northern Spies and some Gravensteins for apple pie. She asked him how Candy was and why she hadn't come with him. He told her Candy was too busy. Everyone liked her, and the kids just hung on her. It would be hard to leave when the time came, Homer confided to Olive. They were of so much use, they were so needed, and the constancy of the demands. "Well, even a day off like this is hard to squeeze in," Homer said. "You mean you won't spend the night?" Olive asked. "Too busy," Homer said, "but we'll both be back in time to put out the bees." "That'll be about Mother's Day," Olive observed. "Right," said Homer Wells. He kissed Olive, whose skin was cool and smelled like ash. Meanie Hyde and Herb Fowler helped him load the pickup. "You gonna plant a whole 40x40 by yourself?" Meanie asked him. "You better hope the ground unfreezes." "You better hope your back holds out," Herb Fowler said. "You better hope your pecker don't fall off." "How's Candy?" Big Dot Taft asked Homer. "Almost as big as you are," Homer thought. "Just fine," he said, "but busy." "I'll bet," said Deborah Pettigrew. In the furnace room, under the lobster tank, Ray Kendall was building his own torpedo. "What for?" Homer asked. "Just to see if I can do it," Ray said. "But what will you fire it at?" Homer asked. "And what will you fire it from?" "The hard part is the gyroscope," Ray said. "It ain't hard to fire it. What's hard is guiding it." "I don't understand," said Homer Wells. "Well, look at you," Ray said. "You're planting an apple orchard at an orphanage. You've been there 5 months, but my daughter's too busy to visit me for a day. I don't understand everything either."
"We'll be back about blossom time," Homer said guiltily.
"That's a nice time of year," said Ray. On the drive back to St. Cloud's, Homer wondered if Ray's coolness or evasiveness was intentional. He decided that Ray's message was clear. "If you keep things from me, I won't explain myself to you."
"A torpedo," Candy said to Homer when he arrived with the baby trees. "What for?"
"Wait and see," said Homer Wells.
Dr. Larch helped him unload the trees.
"They're kind of scrawny, aren't they?" Larch asked.
"They won't give much fruit for 8 or 10 years, Homer said.
"Then I doubt I'll get to eat any of it," said Wilbur Larch.
"Well," Homer said, "even before there are apples on the trees, think how the trees will look on the hill."
"They'll look scrawny," said Wilbur Larch.
Near the top of the hill, the ground was still frozen. Homer couldn't work his spade down far enough. And at the bottom, the holes he dug filled with water. The runoff from the snow was still melting in the woods. Because he would have to wait to plant the trees, he worried about the roots mildewing or getting savaged by mice. But mainly he was peeved that he could not control exactly the calendar of his life. He'd wanted to plant the trees before Candy delivered. He wanted the hillside entirely planted when the baby was born.
"What did I do to make you so compulsively neat?" asked Wilbur Larch.
"Surgery is neat," said Homer Wells. It was the middle of April before Homer could dig the holes and plant the 40x40 orchard, which he did in 3 days, his back so stiff at night that he slept as restlessly and uncomfortably as Candy, tossing and turning with her. It was the first warm night of the spring. They were much too hot under the winter weight blanket. When Candy broke water, they both for a second confused the puddle with their sweat. Homer helped her to the hospital entrance of the boys' division. Nurse Edna prepared Candy while Homer went to talk to Dr. Larch, who was waiting in Nurse Angela's office.
"I deliver this one," Larch said. "There are certain advantages to detachment. Fathers are a bother in the delivery room. If you want to be there, just mind your own business."
"Right," said Homer Wells. He was fidgeting, uncharacteristically, and Dr. Larch smiled at him. Nurse Edna was with Candy, while Nurse Angela scrubbed for Dr. Larch. Homer had already put his mask on when he heard a commotion from the boys' sleeping room. He left the mask on when he went to investigate. One of the John Larches, or the Wilbur Walshes, had got up and gone outside to pee against a trash barrel, with considerable noise. This in turn had disturbed a large raccoon, busy at the trash, and the coon had startled the peeing orphan into wetting his pajamas. Homer tried to sort this out calmly. He wanted to get back to the delivery room. "Peeing indoors is better at night," he observed to the room at large. "Candy's having her baby now." "What's she having?" one of the boys asked.
"Either a boy or a girl," said Homer Wells.
"What will you name it?" another one asked.
"Nurse Angela named me," Homer said.
"Me too,"
several of them said.
"If it's a girl, I'm naming her Angela," said Homer Wells.
"And if it's a boy?"
"If it's a boy, I'll name him Angel," Homer said. "That's really just Angela, without the last A."
"Angel?" someone asked.
"Right," said Homer Wells, and kissed them all good night.
As he was leaving, someone asked him,
"And will you leave it here?"
"No," mumbled Homer Wells, having pulled his mask back up.
"What?"
the orphan shouted.
"No,"
Homer said more clearly, pulling down the mask. It was hot in the delivery room. The warm weather had been unexpected. Because no one had put the screens on, Larch refused to open any windows. At the knowledge that the child, one way or another, would be named after her, Nurse Angela wept so hard that Larch insisted that she change her mask. Nurse Edna was too short to reach the sweat on Larch's forehead. She missed some of it. As the baby's head emerged, a drop of Larch's sweat baptized the child squarely on its temple, literally before it was entirely born. And Homer Wells could not help thinking that this was not unlike David Copperfield being born with a caul. When the shoulders did not follow quickly enough to please Larch, he took the chin and occiput in both hands and drew the infant downward until, in a single easy upward motion, he delivered the posterior shoulder first. Homer Wells, biting his lip, nodded his approval as the anterior shoulder, and the rest of the child followed.
"It's an angel,"
Nurse Edna announced to Candy, who was still smiling an ether smile. Nurse Angela, who had soaked through another mask, had to turn away. Only after the placenta was born did Dr. Larch say, as he sometimes did,
"Perfect."
Then, as he had never before done, he kissed Candy, albeit through his mask, squarely between her wide-open, out-of-ether eyes. The next day it snowed and snowed, an angry April snowstorm, desperate not to relinquish the winter, and Homer looked at his newly planted apple orchard with concern. The frail snow-covered trees reminded him of the luckless geese who'd made an ill-timed landing in the mill pond.
"Stop worrying about the trees," said Wilbur Larch. "They're on their own now."
So was Angel Wells, 8 pounds, 7 ounces, and neither an orphan nor an abortion. One week short of May, there was still too much snow in St. Cloud's for it to be mud season yet. Homer Wells had shaken the individual branches of each of his apple trees, and mouse tracks around one particularly vulnerable-looking winter banana had caused him to scatter poison oats and poison corn. Every tree had a metal sleeve around its slender trunk. Deer had already nibbled the row of macs planted nearest the woods. Homer put out a salt lick for the deer, deeper into the woods in hopes that the salt would keep them there. Candy was nursing Angel, whose crusty remnant of an umbilical had fallen off cleanly and whose circumcision had healed. Homer had circumcised his son. You need the practice, Dr. Larch had told him. You want me to practice on my son? Homer had asked.
May it be the only pain you ever cause him, Wilbur Larch had replied.
There was still ice on the inside of the window panes in the morning. Homer would hold his finger to the pane until his finger was bright red, wet and cold, and then he'd touch Candy with the finger, which woke her up when she was slow to respond to his gentler touching of her stubble. Homer and Candy loved how they fit together in the bed again, and how Angel could fit between them when Candy was nursing him, and how Candy's milk would sometimes wake them both up before Angel's crying would. They agreed they had never been happier. So what if the sky, when it was almost May, was still the slate color of February, and still streaked with sleet? So what if the secret they kept in St. Cloud's could not be kept forever, and was already a secret that half of Hart's Haven and Hart's Rock had the sense to figure out for themselves? People from Maine don't crowd you. They'd let you come to your senses in your own good time. Every 2 days there was a ritual weighing of Angel Wells, which was always conducted in the dispensary. Nurse Angela keeping the record, Dr. Larch and Homer taking turns at poking Angel's belly, looking into Angel's eyes, and feeling Angel's grip.
Admit it, Nurse Edna said to Candy and Homer at one such weighing-in ceremony. You like it here.
That day in St. Cloud's it was 33 degrees. The wet snow, with which the morning had begun, had turned to freezing rain. That day in Hart's Rock, Olive Worthington had her own secret. Perhaps if Homer and Candy had been more forthcoming to her, Olive would have shared her secret with them. She would have grabbed the phone and called them. But people from Maine don't like the telephone, a rude invention. Especially in the case of important news, a telephone catches you too off guard. A telegram provides you with a decent, respectful interval in which to gather your senses and respond. Olive sent them her secret in a telegram. That gave everyone a little more time. Candy would see the telegram first. She was nursing Angel in the girls' division to quite an appreciative audience of girl orphans. When Mrs. Grogan brought her the telegram, which one of the lackeys who slaved for the station master had finally gotten around to delivering. The telegram was an obvious shock to Candy, who quite abruptly handed Angel to Mrs. Grogan, although Angel did not appear to be through nursing. It astonished Mrs. Grogan that Candy did not even pause to properly replace her breast in her bra. She just buttoned her blouse over herself and, in spite of the weather, ran outdoors and across to the hospital entrance of the boys' division. At the time, Homer was asking Dr. Larch if he, Larch, thought that an X-ray of his, Homer's heart, might prove instructive to Homer. Wilbur Larch was thinking very carefully about his answer when Candy burst upon them. Olive Worthington was a Yankee who knew the price of a telegram, the cost of words, yet her enthusiasm for her subject had clearly carried her away. She went far beyond her usual shorthand self. Wally found alive, stop. Recovering encephalitis, Ceylon, stop. Liberated from Rangoon, Burma, stop. Temperature 92 degrees, stop. Weight 105 pounds, stop. Paralyzed, stop. Love, Olive.
105 pounds, said Homer Wells.
Alive, Candy whispered.
Paralyzed, Nurse Angela said.
Encephalitis, said Wilbur Larch.
How could his temperature be 92 degrees, Wilbur? Nurse Edna asked.
Dr. Larch didn't know. He wouldn't venture a guess. It was another one of those details, the clarification of which would take quite a long time. For Captain Worthington, who had abandoned his plane over Burma about 10 months ago, the clarification of many such details would take years. It was raining so heavily when he jumped, it seemed to Wally that his parachute had to push against the rain to open. Yet the roar of the plane was so near, Wally was afraid he'd pulled the cord too soon. He was afraid of the bamboo. He'd heard stories of flyers being impaled by it. But he missed the bamboo and landed in a teak tree, a branch of which separated his shoulder. His head may have hit the trunk, or else the pain in his shoulder caused him to lose consciousness. It was dark when he woke up, and since he couldn't see how far below the ground was, he didn't dare to free himself from the chute cords until morning. Then he gave himself too much morphine for his shoulder and lost the syringe in the dark. In his haste to abandon the plane, he'd not had time to locate a machete. In the morning he spent quite a while cutting through the chute cords, using only the bayonet in his ankle sheath, and having the use of only one strong arm. He was lowering himself to the ground when his dog tags caught on a vine, and because of his bad shoulder he could neither support all his weight with one arm nor free the tags, and so he lost them. The chain cut his neck when the tags came off, and he landed on an old teakwood log that was hidden under the ferns and the dead palm fronds. The log rolled, and he sprained his ankle. When he realized that in the monsoon weather he would never know east from west, that was when he discovered that his compass was gone. He rubbed some sulfur powder on his cut neck. Wally had no idea where China was. He picked his way by moving through whatever was the least dense. In this way, after 3 days, he had the impression that the jungle was either thinning out or that he was getting better at picking his way through it. China was east of Wally, but Wally went south. China was up over the mountains, but Wally sought the valleys. Where Wally was, the valleys ran southwesterly. He was right about one thing. The jungle was thinning out. It was also getting warmer. Every night he climbed a tree and slept in its crotch. The large twisted trunks of the peepul tree, as gnarled as giant wooden cables, made the best crotches for sleeping. But Wally wasn't the first creature to figure this out. One night, at eye level, in the crotch of a peepul tree next to him, a leopard was examining itself for ticks. Wally followed the leopard's example and discovered several. He gave up trying to remove the leeches. One day he saw a python, a small one, about 15 feet. It was lying on a rock, swallowing something the approximate size and shape of a beagle. Wally guessed it was a monkey, although he couldn't remember if he'd seen any monkeys. He had seen monkeys, of course, but he'd forgotten them. He had a fever. He tried to take his temperature, but the thermometer in his first aid kit was broken. The day he saw a tiger swim across a river was the day he began to notice the mosquitoes. The climate was changing. The river with the tiger in it had produced a broader valley. The forest was changing, too. He caught a fish with his hands and ate its liver raw. He cooked frogs as big as cats, but their legs were fishier than the frog legs he remembered. Perhaps it was the lack of garlic. He ate something that was the consistency of a mango and had no taste whatsoever. The fruit left a musty aftertaste, and for a whole day he vomited and had chills. Then the river where he'd seen the tiger turned into a bigger river. The monsoon water had a powerful current. Wally was encouraged to build a raft. He remembered the rafts he had engineered for travel on Drinkwater Lake, and he cried to think how much harder it was to build a raft with bamboo and vines than with pitch pine and ropes, and stray boards and nails. And how much heavier the green bamboo was, too. It didn't matter that the raft leaked, it barely floated, and if he needed to portage, he knew he couldn't carry it. He noticed more mosquitoes, especially when the river broadened and the current slowed down, and he just drifted. He had no idea how many days he drifted, or when he first knew for certain that he had a fever. About the time he saw the rice paddies and the water buffaloes, he would say later. One day he would remember waving to the women in the rice paddies. They looked so surprised to see him. When Wally saw the rice paddies, he must have known he'd gone the wrong way. He had gone into the heart of Burma, which is shaped like a kite with a long tail. He was much nearer to Mandalay than he was to China, and the Japanese held Mandalay. But Wally had a fever of 104. He just drifted. Sometimes he couldn't tell the river from the rice paddies. It was strange how both the men and women wore long skirts, but only the men covered their hair. They wore what looked like baskets on their heads, and the baskets were wrapped with strips of brightly colored silk. The women's heads were bare, but many of them put flowers in their hair. Both the men and the women braided their hair. They seemed to be eating all the time, but they were just chewing betel nuts. The teeth were stained. Their lips made them appear as if they'd been drinking blood, but that was just the betel juice. The shelters they took Wally to were all alike. One story, thatched houses on bamboo stilts. The families ate outdoors on a porch. They gave him rice and tea and lots of things with curry. When his fever went down, Wally ate pante causa, noodles and chicken, and nasakin, curried fish balls. Those were the first words that his Burmese rescuers tried to teach him, but Wally misunderstood. He thought nasakin was the name of the man who had carried him off the raft and held Wally's head steady, while the man's wife fed Wally with her fingers. She was wonderfully small and wore a sheer white blouse. Her husband touched the blouse and called it by name, trying to teach Wally more of his language. "Engis," the man said, and Wally thought that was the wife's name. She smelled like the inside of the thatched houses. She smelled like chintz and lemon rind. They were such a nice couple, Nasakin and Engis. Wally repeated their names out loud and smiled. They smiled back at him. Mr. Curried Fish Balls and his wife, Mrs. Blouse. She smelled as sticky sweet as frangipani. She smelled as citrus as bergamot. With the fever had come the stiffness in his neck and back, but when the fever broke and he stopped vomiting, when the headaches were over and the shaking chills were gone and he wasn't even nauseous anymore, that was when he noticed the paralysis. At that time it was a stiff paralysis in both his lower and upper extremities. Spasticity, Wilbur Larch would have called it. Wally's arms and legs stuck straight out, and he couldn't move them. He was delirious for 2 or 3 weeks, and when he tried to talk, his speech was thick and slow. He had trouble eating because of the tremors in his lips and tongue. He couldn't empty his bladder, and the natives had to catheterize him with a tiny rough bamboo shoot in order for him to urinate at all. And they kept moving him. They always moved him over water. Once he saw elephants. They were dragging logs out of the forests. The surface of the water was forever interrupted with turtles and black snakes and water hyacinths and beetle juice, a darker red than the blood that traced Wally's urine. "Nasakin?" Wally asked. "Engis?" he asked. "Where'd they gone?" Although the faces of his rescuers kept changing, they seemed to understand him. "Must come from a big family," Wally thought. "I'm paralyzed, aren't I?" he asked the small pretty men and women, who always smiled. One of the women washed and combed his hair. Her whole family watched Wally's hair drying in the sun, the blonde light leaping into it as it dried. How that impressed them! They gave him a long, sheer white blouse to wear. "Engis," they said. "Oh, it's a present from her," he thought. Then they covered his blonde hair with a dark wig. It was a waxy pigtail, and they piled it high on top of his head and studded it with flowers. The children giggled. They shaved his face so close his skin burned. They shaved his legs, below the knee where his legs protruded from the long skirt they made him wear. The game was to make him a woman. The game was to make him safe, to make him blend in. Because his face was so pretty, it was easier for them to make him a woman than a man. The ideal Burmese woman has no breasts. It is a shame that they weren't more careful when they catheterized him. They were so careful about everything else. The bamboo shoot wasn't always clean. The catheter's roughness hurt him and made him bleed, but it was the dirtiness that would give him the infection. The infection would make him sterile. The epididymis, Wilbur Larch could have informed him, is a single-coiled tube in which the sperm mature after leaving the testicle. Epididymitis, an infection of that little tube, prevents sperm from reaching the sperm duct. In Wally's case, the infection would permanently seal his tube. They were correct to catheterize him. It was only the how that was wrong. He suffered urinary retention. His bladder was distended. They had no choice but to relieve him. At times, Wally would wonder if there wasn't an easier way, or if the bamboo was clean. But what could he say to them? "Engis," he would say. "Nasakin?" he would ask them. Months later, he would hear bombing. "Irrawaddy," they would explain. They were bombing the oil fields along the Irrawaddy. Wally knew where he was. He used to bomb those fields, too. Before he heard the bombing, and as always disguised as a woman, he was taken to a doctor in Mandalay. His eyes were smarting because they'd rubbed a curry paste on his face to make him look brown. But but up close with those blue eyes and that patrician nose, he couldn't have fooled anyone. He saw many Japanese in Mandalay. The doctor had trouble explaining to Wally what was wrong with him. He said the following in English. Japanese bee mosquito. I was bitten by a Japanese mosquito, Wally said. But what's a bee mosquito, he wondered. He no longer needed a catheter to pee, but the infection had done its damage. By the time he heard the bombing of the Irrawaddy, the paralysis had left his upper extremities. He had the full use of his arms again, and the spasticity had left his legs. Although his legs were still paralyzed, it was a flaccid paralysis and not quite symmetrical. His left leg was more dead than his right. His bladder was okay, and except for the effects of curry, his bowels were okay, too. What he could detect of his sexual function felt normal. There are no autonomic effects to encephalitis, Wilbur Larch would explain to Candy and to Homer Wells. What's that mean? Candy asked. It means that Wally can have a normal sex life, said Homer Wells, who didn't know about Wally's epididymis. Wally would have a normal sex life, but he wouldn't have an adequate sperm count. He would still have orgasm and ejaculation, since so much of the ejaculate is made in the prostate, which is quite a way downstream. He just could never make his own baby. At the time, none of them knew Wally had been sterilized. They knew only about the encephalitis. Wally caught it from the mosquitoes. It was called Japanese bee encephalitis, and it was quite common in Asia during the war. It is an arthropod-borne virus, Wilbur Larch explained. Residual flaccid paralysis of the lower extremities was not a common effect of the disease, but it was well enough known to be documented. There are numerous changes that occur in the tissue of the brain, but the changes in the spinal cord look very much like polio. The incubation period is about a week long, and the acute disease process lasts only a week or 10 days. The recovery is very slow, with muscular tremors lasting sometimes for months. Considering that it comes from birds, it's a big disease, Wilbur Larch said to Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela. The mosquito picks up the virus from birds and transmits it to men and other large animals. Wally's face was so pretty, and he'd lost so much weight. That was why they disguised him as a woman. The Japanese were both attracted to and intimidated by the Burmese women, especially the Padong women with their high brass collars wound in spirals to stretch their necks. That Wally was a woman and an invalid made him an untouchable. That they had made him look Eurasian also made him an outcast. When the monsoon season ended in October, they either traveled on the river at nights or they protected him from the sun with an umbrella and with more curry paste. He got very tired of curried fish balls, but he kept asking for them. For so the Burmese thought, that was all they gave him. And when he was delirious, he said Candy's name. One of the boatmen asked him about it. Candy? The boatman inquired politely. That day they were in a sampan. Wally lay under a roof of mats and watched the boatman sculling. Agnes, Wally said. He meant, like her, a good woman, a wife. The boatman nodded. At the next port on the river, Wally didn't know where, it might have been Yandun, they gave him another sheer white blouse. Candy, the boatman said. Wally thought he meant give it to Candy. He smiled. He just kept drifting. The sampan's sharp nose seemed to smell the way. It was a country of smells to Wally. It was a fragrant dream. Wilbur Larch could imagine Wally's journey. It was an ether journey, of course. Elephants in oil fields, rice paddies and bombs falling, dressed up as a woman and paralyzed from the waist down. Larch had been there. He had been everywhere. He had no trouble imagining Rangoon and water buffaloes. Every ether dream has its equivalent of British underground agents smuggling American pilots across the Bay of Bengal. Wally's trip through Burma was a voyage Wilbur Larch had often undertaken. The blackcurrant odor of petunias was at war with the odor of dung all the way. They flew Wally across the Bay of Bengal in a small plane with a British pilot and a Sinhalese crew. Wilbur Larch had taken many such flights.
"You speak Sinhala?"
the Englishman asked Wally, who sat in the co-pilot's seat. The pilot smelled of garlic and turmeric.
"I don't even know what Sinala is," Wally said. When he shut his eyes, he could still see the white, waxy flowers of the wild lime bushes. He could still see the jungle.
"Principal language of Ceylon, my boy," the pilot said. The pilot also smelled like tea.
"We're going to Ceylon?" Wally asked.
"Can't keep a blonde in Burma, lad," the Englishman said. "Don't you know Burma's full of nips?"
But Wally preferred to remember his native friends. They had taught him to salaam, a low bow with the right hand on the forehead, always the right hand, they'd explained. It was a bow of salutation. And when he was sick, someone had always stirred the punkah for him. A punkah is a large, screen-shaped fan that is moved by a rope, pulled by a servant.
"Punkah," Wally said to the English pilot.
"What's that, lad?" the pilot asked.
"It's so hot," said Wally, who felt drowsy.
They were flying at a very low altitude, and the little plane was an oven. A brief scent of sandalwood came through the stronger garlic in the pilot's sweat.
92 degrees American when we left Rangoon," the pilot said.
The pilot got a kick out of saying American instead of Fahrenheit, but Wally didn't notice.
92 degrees, Wally said.
It felt like the first fact he could hang his hat on, as they say in Maine.
"What happened to the legs?" the Englishman asked casually.
"Japanese bee mosquito," Wally explained. The British pilot looked very grave. He thought that Wally meant a plane, that the Japanese bee mosquito was the name of the fighter plane that shot Wally's plane down.
"I don't know that one, lad," the pilot admitted to Wally. "Thought I'd seen them all, but you can't trust the nips."
The Sinhalese crew had slathered themselves with coconut oil and were wearing sarongs and long collarless shirts. Two of them were eating something, and one of them was screeching into the radio. The pilot said something sharply to the radio man, who instantly lowered his voice.
"Sinhala's an awful language," the pilot confided to Wally. "Sounds like cats fucking."
When Wally didn't respond to his humor, the Englishman asked him if he'd ever been to Ceylon. When Wally didn't answer him, Wally seemed to be daydreaming. The Englishman said,
"We not only planted their first rubber trees and developed their bloody rubber plantations, we taught them how to brew tea. They knew how to grow it all right, but you couldn't get a decent cup of tea on the whole bloody island. Now they want to be independent," the Englishman said.
92 degrees, Wally said, smiling.
"Yes, just trying to relax, lad," the pilot said.
When Wally burped, he tasted like cinnamon. When he shut his eyes, he saw African marigolds come out like stars. Suddenly the three Sinhalese began to speak at once. First the radio would say something, then the three of them would speak in unison.
"Bloody Buddhists, all of them," the pilot explained. "They even pray on the bloody radio. At Ceylon," the Englishman said. 2/3 tea and 1/3 rubber and prayer."
He yelled something at the Sinhalese, who lowered their voices. Somewhere over the Indian Ocean, shortly before sighting Ceylon, the pilot was worried about an aircraft in his vicinity.
"Pray now, damn you," he said to the Sinhalese, who were all asleep.
"That Japanese bee mosquito," the Englishman said to Wally.
"What does it look like?" he asked.
"Or did it get you from behind?"
But all Wally would say was, 92 degrees. After the war, Ceylon would become an independent nation. 24 years after that, the country would change its name to Sri Lanka. But all Wally would remember was how hot it had been. In a way, his parachute had never touched down. In a way, he had remained over Burma for 10 months, just floating there. All Wally would remember of his own story would never make as much sense as an ether frolic. And how he would survive the war, sterile, paralyzed, both legs flaccid, had already been dreamed by Big Dot Taft. It was 34 degrees in St. Clouds when Homer Wells went to the railroad station and dictated a telegram to Olive to the station master. Homer could not have phoned her and lied to her that directly. And hadn't Olive telegrammed them? She must have had her reasons for not wanting to talk on the phone. It was with the almost certain feeling that Ray and Olive knew everything that Homer and Candy were doing that Homer dictated his telegram to Olive, respecting a polite formality as faint as a suspicion. It was a suspicion that could be proven only impolitely, and Homer Wells was polite. God bless you and Wally. Stop. When will we see him? Stop. Candy and I home soon? Stop. I have adopted a baby boy. Stop. Love, Homer.
You're kind of young to adopt somebody, ain't you? The station master asked.
Right, said Homer Wells. Candy telephoned her father.
That's going to be weeks or maybe months before they can move him, Ray told her. He's got to gain some weight before he can travel so far, and there are probably tests they got to do. And there's still a war on, don't forget.
At her end of the phone, Candy just cried and cried.
Tell me how you are, darling, Ray Kendall said. That was when she could have told him that she just had Homer's baby, but what she said was, Homer's adopted one of the orphans. After a pause, Raymond Kendall said,
Just one of them?
He's adopted a baby boy, Candy said. Of course, I'll help, too. We've kind of adopted a baby together.
You have, Ray said.
His name is Angel, Candy said.
Bless his heart, Ray said.
Bless you both, too.
Candy cried some more.
Adopted, huh? Ray asked his daughter.
Yes, said Candy Kendall. One of the orphans.
She quit the breastfeeding, and Nurse Edna introduced her to the device for pumping her breasts. Angel disliked his conversion to formula milk, and for a few days he displayed a cranky temperament. Candy displayed a cranky temperament, too. When Homer observed that her pubic hair would very nearly be grown back by the time she returned to Hart's Haven, she snapped at him.
"For God's sake, who's going to see whether I have pubic hair or not, except you?" Candy asked.
Homer showed signs of strain, too.
He was impatient with Dr. Larch's suggestion that Homer's future lay in the medical profession.
Larch insisted on giving Homer a brand-new copy of Grey's Anatomy. He also gave him the standard Greenhill's Office Gynecology and the British masterpiece Diseases of Women.
"Jesus Christ," said Homer Wells. "I'm a father, and I'm going to be an apple farmer."
"You have near-perfect obstetrical procedure," Larch told him. "You just need a little more of the gynecological, and the pediatric, of course."
"Maybe I'll end up a lobsterman," Homer said.
"And I'll send you a subscription to the New England Journal of Medicine," Dr. Larch said. "And a JAMA at SG&O."
"You're the doctor," said Homer Wells tiredly.
"How do you feel?" Candy asked Homer.
"Like an orphan," Homer said.
They held each other tightly, but they did not make love.
"How do you feel?" Homer asked.
"I won't know until I see him," Candy said honestly.
"What will you know then?" Homer asked.
"If I love him, or you, or both of you," she said. "Or else I won't know any more than I know now."
"It's always wait and see, isn't it?" Homer asked.
"You don't expect me to tell him anything when he's still over there, do you?" Candy asked.
"No, of course I don't expect that," he said softly.
She held him tighter. She began to cry again.
"Oh, Homer," she said, "how can he weigh only 105 pounds?
"I'm sure he'll gain some weight," Homer said. But his entire body shivered suddenly. Wally's body had been so strong.
Homer remembered the first time Wally had taken him to the ocean. The surf had been unusually rough, and Wally had warned him about the undertow. Wally had taken him by the hand and shown him how to duck under the waves and how to ride them. They had walked along the beach for an hour, undistracted by Candy. She had been tanning.
"I don't understand all this stupid lying down in the sun," Wally had told Homer, who agreed. "You're either doing something in the sun and you pick up a little color, or you're doing something else. But you're doing something, that's the main thing."
They were picking up shells and stones. The beachcombers searched for specimens. Homer was immediately impressed with the smoothness of the stones and the broken pieces of shell, how the water and the sand had softened them. "This is a very experienced piece," Wally had said, handing Homer an especially worn bit of shell. It had no edges. "Experienced," Homer had said. And after that, Wally had said, "And this is a worldly stone," exhibiting an old, smooth one. Homer thought that his desire for candy had changed everything, even the natural process of the grinding smooth of stones and shells. If he and Wally went back to the beach, would they still be beachcombers? Or was it inevitable that the love of a woman would alter even their most commonplace experiences together? "Was he my friend for 5 minutes?" wondered Homer Wells. "And my rival for the rest of my life?" Homer entrusted Nurse Edna with the care of the hillside orchard. He explained that the wire mesh sleeves around the trees could not be wrapped so tightly that they didn't permit the trees to grow, but also not so loosely that the mice could girdle the trees. He showed her how to spot the tunnels of the pine mice who ate the roots. Everyone kissed Candy goodbye, even Wilbur Larch, who, when he reached to shake Homer's hand, appeared embarrassed that Homer brushed past his hand and hugged him, and kissed him on his leathery neck. Nurse Edna sobbed the most freely. As soon as the pickup truck rolled past the girls' division, Wilbur Larch closed himself in the dispensary. It was a Sunday, so Raymond Kendall was at work on his homemade torpedo when Homer brought Candy home. Candy told Homer that she could not face seeing Olive until the next morning, but she was gripped by an unforeseen panic when Homer drove off with Angel. Although her milk was gone, she knew she would still wake up to her baby's clock, even though it would be Homer alone who was hearing the actual cries. And how many nights had it been since she had slept alone? She would tell Homer the next day, "We've got to find a way to share him. I mean, even before we tell Olive, not to mention Wally, we have to both take care of him. We have to both be with him. I just miss him too much." "I miss you," Homer Wells told her. He was an orphan who'd had a family for less than a month of his life, and he was not prepared to not have a family again. When he and Angel arrived at Ocean View, Olive greeted Homer as if she were his mother. She threw her arms around him and kissed him and wept. "Show me that baby. Oh, his darling," she cried. "Whatever possessed you? You're so young and you're all alone." "Well, the baby was all alone, too," Homer mumbled, "and Candy will help me with him." "Of course," Olive said. "I'll help you, too." She carried Angel to Wally's room, where Homer was surprised to see a crib, and more baby things for just one baby than could have been collected in a thorough search of both the boys' and girls' divisions in St. Cloud's. An army of bottles for the formula awaited Homer in the kitchen. Olive had even bought a special pot for sterilizing the nipples. In the linen closet there were more diapers than there were pillowcases and sheets and towels. For the first time in his life, Homer felt that he'd been adopted. To his horror, he saw that Olive loved him. "I think that you and Angel should have Wally's room," Olive said. She had obviously been busy planning. "Wally won't be able to climb stairs, so I'm having the dining room made into a bedroom. We can always eat in the kitchen, and the dining room has that terrace for when the weather's nice. I'm having a ramp built from the terrace to the patio around the pool for the wheelchair." As Homer held her while she cried, a new guilt surrounded him, like the nightfall. That ever-old, ever-new remorse that Mr. Rochester had told Jane Eyre to dread. That poison of life. In the second week of May, Ira Titcomb and Homer worked alongside each other, putting the bees out in the orchards. It was the start of blossom time, the night before Mother's Day, when they put out the hives. Everyone remembered Mother's Day that year. No one forgot Olive. The house was full of little presents and lots of apple blossoms, and some of the work crew even gave Homer a Mother's Day present. They thought it was so funny that he'd adopted a baby. "Just imagine you with your very own baby," was the way Big Dot Taft put it. In the apple mart, where they were giving the display tables a fresh coat of paint, there were two babies on display. Angel Wells and Florence and Meanie Hyde's boy, Pete. Pete Hyde looked like a potato compared to Angel Wells, which is to say that his disposition was entirely bland and he had no apparent bones in his face. "Well, Homer, your angel is an angel," Florence Hyde would say, "and my Pete's a Pete." The Applemart women teased him endlessly. Homer just smiled. Deborah Pettigrew was especially interested in handling Angel Wells. She would look intently into the baby's face for the longest time before announcing that she was sure the baby was going to look just like Homer. Only more aristocratic, she guessed. Squeeze Louise said the baby was too precious for words. When Homer was out in the field, either Olive or one of the Applemart women looked after Angel, but most of the time Candy looked after her baby. "We kind of adopted him together," she would explain. She said it so often that Olive said Candy was as much of a mother to that child as Homer was. And Olive, therefore, as a kind of joke, gave Candy a Mother's Day present, too. All the while the bees did their work, carrying pollen from the frying pan to Cock Hill, and the honey leaked between the clapboards that housed the hives. One morning, on a corner of the newspaper, Homer Wells saw Olive's handwriting, a penciled remark above the day's headlines, any one of which might have prompted Olive to respond. But somehow Homer thought the remark was written to him. "Intolerable dishonesty," Olive had written. And one night Candy overheard Ray. Her bedroom light was out. In the pitch dark she heard her father say, "It's not wrong, but it's not right." At first she thought he was on the telephone. After she drifted back to sleep, the sound of her door opening and closing woke her up again, and she realized Ray had been sitting in her room with her, addressing her in her sleep, in the darkness. And some of the nights in blossom time, Candy would say to Homer, "You're an overworked father." "Isn't he?" Olive would say admiringly. "I'm going to take this kid off your hands for the night," Candy would say. And Homer would smile through the tension of these exchanges. He would wake up alone in Wally's room in anticipation of Angel needing his bottle. He could imagine Raymond Kendall getting up to heap the formula, and Candy being in her bed with the bottle of formula in as near an approximation of the correct angle of her breast as she could arrange it. Ray's torpedo parts were stolen from the Kittery Navy Yard. Both Homer and Candy knew that's how he got them, but only Candy criticized Ray for it. "I've caught more mistakes in the way they do things than they know things to do," Ray said. "Not likely they could catch me." "But what's it for, anyway?" Candy asked her father. "I don't like there being a bomb here, especially when there's a baby in the house."
"Well, when I got the torpedo," Ray explained, "I didn't know about the baby."
"Well, you know now," Candy said. "Why don't you fire it at something? At something far away."
"When it's ready, I'll fire it," Ray said.
"What are you going to fire it at?" Homer asked Raymond Kendall.
"I don't know," Ray said. "Maybe the Haven Club, the next time they tell me I spoil their view."
"I don't like not knowing what you're doing something for," Candy told her father when they were alone.
"It's like this," Ray said slowly. "I'll tell you what it's like. A torpedo. It's like Wally coming home. You know he's coming. You can't calculate the damage."
Candy asked Homer for an interpretation of Ray's meaning. "He's not telling you anything," Homer said. "He's fishing. He wants you to tell him." "Suppose it all just goes on the way it is," Candy asked Homer, after they had made love in the cider house, which had not yet been cleaned for use in the harvest.
"The way it is," said Homer Wells.
"Yes," she said. "Just suppose that we wait and we wait. How long could we wait?" she asked. "I mean, after a while, suppose it gets easier to wait than to tell."
"We'll have to tell sometime," said Homer Wells.
"When?" Candy asked. "When Wally comes home," Homer said. "When he comes home paralyzed and weighing less than I weigh," Candy said. "Is that when we spring it on him?" she asked. "Are there things you can't ease into?" wondered Homer Wells. "The scalpel," he remembered, "has a certain heft. One does not need to press on it. It seems to cut on its own. But one does need to take charge of it in a certain way.
When one takes it up, one has to move it. A scalpel does not require the authority of force, but it demands of the user the authority of motion.
We have to know where we're going, said Homer Wells.
But what if we don't know, Candy asked. What if we know only how we want to stay? What if we wait and wait?
Do you mean that you won't ever know if you love him or me? Homer asked her.
It may be all confused by how much he's going to need me, Candy said. Homer put his hand on her, where her pubic hair had grown back almost exactly as it was.
You don't think I'll need you too? He asked her.
She rolled to her other hip, turning her back to him, but at the same time taking his hand from where he touched her and clamping his hand to her breast.
We'll have to wait and see, she said.
Past a certain point, I won't wait, said Homer Wells.
What point is that? Candy asked.
Because his hand was on her breast, he could feel her holding her breath.
When Angel is old enough to either know he's an orphan or know who his parents are, Homer said.
That's the point. I won't have Angel thinking he's adopted. I won't have him not knowing who his mother and father are.
I'm not worried about Angel, Candy said. Angel will get lots of love. I'm worried about you and me.
And Wally, Homer said.
We'll go crazy, Candy said.
We won't go crazy, Homer said. We've got to take care of Angel and make him feel loved.
But what if I don't feel loved, or you don't? What then? Candy asked him.
We'll wait until then, said Homer Wells. We'll just wait and see, he said, almost with a vengeance.
The spring breeze blew over them, bearing with it the sickly sweet stench of rotten apples. The smell had an almost ammonia power that so overwhelmed Homer Wells that he released Candy's breast and covered his mouth and nose with his hand. It was not until the summer when Candy first heard directly from Wally. She got an actual letter, her first communication from him since he'd been shot down a year ago. Wally had spent 6 months in Mount Lavinia Hospital in Ceylon. They had not wanted to move him from there until he'd gained 15 pounds, until his muscle tremors had ceased, and his speech had lost the daydreaming vacantness of malnutrition. He wrote the letter from another hospital in New Delhi. After a month in India, he had gained an additional 10 pounds. He said that he'd learned to put cinnamon in his tea, and that the slap of sandals was nearly constant in the hospital. They were promising him that they would allow him to commence the long trip home when he weighed 140 pounds, and when he had mastered a few basic exercises that were essential to his rehabilitation. He couldn't describe the route of his proposed voyage home because of the censors. Wally hoped that the censors would understand, in the light of his paralysis, that it was necessary for him to say something about his perfectly normal sexual function. The censors had allowed this to pass. Wally still didn't know he was sterile. He knew he'd had a urinary tract infection and that the infection was gone.
"And how is Homer? How I miss him," Wally wrote.
But that was not the part of the letter that devastated Candy. Candy was so devastated by the beginning of the letter that the rest of the letter was simply a continuing devastation to her.
"I'm so afraid that you won't want to marry a cripple," Wally began.
In her single bed, tugged into sleep and into wakefulness by the tide, Candy stared at the picture of her mother on the night table. She would have liked a mother to talk to at the moment, and perhaps because she had no memory of her mother, she remembered the first night she had arrived at the orphanage. Dr. Larch had been reading to the boys from Great Expectations. Candy would never forget the line that she and Homer had walked in on. "I awoke without having parted in my sleep with the perception of my wretchedness," Wilbur Larch had read aloud. Either Dr. Larch had predetermined that he would end the evening's reading with that line, or else he had only then noticed Candy and Homer Wells in the open doorway. The harsh hall light, a naked bulb, formed a kind of institutional halo above their heads, and had lost his place in the book, causing him, spur of the moment, to stop reading. For whatever reason, that perception of wretchedness had been Candy's introduction to St. Cloud's, and the beginning and the end of her bedtime story.
Chapter 10 15 Years. For 15 years they were a couple, Lorna and Melanie. They were set in their ways. Once the young rebels of the women-only boarding house, they now occupied the choicest rooms, with the river view, and they served as superintendents to the building for a consideration regarding their rent. Melanie was handy. She had learned plumbing and electricity at the shipyard, where she was one of a staff of 3 electricians. The other 2 were men, but they never messed with Melanie. No one ever would. Lorna became more domestic. She lacked the concentration for advanced training at the shipyard, but she remained an employee. "Stay on for the pension plan," Melanie had advised her. Lorna actually liked the assembly line monotony, and she was smart about signing up for the overtime pay shifts. She was willing to work at odd hours if she could work less. Her being out late bothered Melanie. Lorna became increasingly feminine. She not only wore dresses, even to work, and used more makeup and perfume, and watched her weight. Her voice, which had once been harsh, actually softened, and she developed a smile, especially when she was being criticized. Melanie found her increasingly passive. As a couple, they fought rarely because Lorna would not fight back. In 15 years, she had discovered that Melanie relented if there wasn't a struggle. Given any resistance, Melanie would never quit. "You don't fight fair," Melanie would occasionally complain. "You're much bigger than I am," Lorna would say coyly. An understatement. By 1950-something, when Melanie was 40-something, no one knew exactly how old she was, she weighed 175 pounds. She was 5 feet 8 inches tall. She was almost 50 inches around at her chest, which meant that she wore men's shirts. Large. Anything smaller than a 17-inch neck wouldn't fit her. Because her arms were short, she always had to roll up the sleeves. She had a 36-inch waist, but only a 28-inch inseam, which meant she had to roll up the cuffs of her trousers or have Lorna shorten them. Melanie's pants were always so tight across her thighs that they quickly lost their crease there, but they were very baggy in the seat. Melanie was not fat-assed, and she had the nondescript hips of most men. She had small feet, which always hurt her. In 15 years, she'd been arrested only once, for fighting. Actually, the charge was assault, but in the end she was stuck with nothing more damaging than a disturbance of the peace. She'd been in the ladies' room of a pizza bar in Bath when some college boy had tried to engage Lorna in conversation. When he saw Melanie take her place beside Lorna at the bar, he whispered to Lorna, "I don't think I could find anyone for your friend." He was imagining a possible double-date situation. "Speak up," Melanie said. "Whispering is impolite." "I said, I don't think I could find a date for you," the boy said boldly. Melanie put her arm around Lorna and cupped her breast. "I couldn't find a sheepdog that would hold still for you," Melanie told the college boy. "Fucking dyke," he said as he was leaving. He thought he'd spoken quietly enough, and strictly to impress the shipyard workers at the far end of the bar. He couldn't have known that the men were Melanie's co-workers. They held the college boy while Melanie broke his nose with a metal napkin container. The way that Melanie liked to fall asleep was with her big face on Lorna's tight, bare belly. Lorna could always tell when Melanie had fallen asleep because of the change in Melanie's breathing, which Lorna could feel against her pubic hair. In 15 years there was only one night when Lorna had asked her friend to move her heavy head before she had fallen soundly asleep. "What is it? You got cramps?" Melanie asked. "No, I'm pregnant," Lorna said. Melanie thought it was a joke until Lorna went into the bathroom to be sick. When Lorna came back to bed, Melanie said, "I want to try to understand this, calmly. We've been like a married couple for 15 years, and now you're pregnant." Lorna curled herself into a ball around one of the pillows. She covered her head with the other pillow. Her face and her stomach and her private parts were protected, but still she trembled. She began to cry. "I guess what you're telling me," Melanie went on,
is that when women are fucking each other, it takes a lot longer for one of them to get pregnant than when a woman is fucking some guy, right?
Lorna didn't answer her. She just went on